Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
episode 6 of reading through MRI scanners, or MRI scans in a bit more detail. These are these big magnets, and essentially you can actually see inside in exquisite detail inside people, and you can differentiate organs much better than you could actually do if you actually cut them open. You can't touch them, but you can actually detect the amount of water, chemicals, diffusion, all these beautiful things. You can even map nerve fibers by looking at Brownian motion of water. You can see all these molecular properties that you couldn't see. That's cut in three dimensions as you go through an MRI scanner. And it's one of these things where I've just, like books, thrown myself at it and read the general Wikipedia article, and to my surprise find that there's a supplementary physics of MRI scanning. And sort of held inside that is all of a sudden, hey, a warning, you have to understand wave science. And as a quantum mechanics, quantum physicist, I have a strong understanding of that. No, I'm not, yeah, you just have to. It's sort of like, I suppose, a brickie being able to lay bricks. A quantum physicist is able to handle wave equations. And this entire dance between real spatial space and frequency space, and all the tricks that they have done with respect to real space, time space, and physical space. It's quite amazing to see what they've done, and it's reached a section where I can understand certain things like Fourier transforms, but the actual use of gradients, how they use, are just a little bit out of my scope to see how it's going. And I think the actual people writing the article, it's a bit out of their scope. I'm sure they do understand it, but they haven't explained it. And so you've got your spin echo and gradient echo. Now, I'm just trying to work out what gradient echo is, and the difference between gradient echo and the gradients you use, spatial gradients you use to encode positional information with frequency information, which can be read out. So essentially you get a signal, and your the signal is very clever. That comes out that when you actually look at it, the Fourier deconvolution and frequency space, you actually get a real image. So this is a bit confusing. Now we're up to this point of the physics of MRI scanning, and I'll keep on doing this until we actually get it. The construction and operation of an MRI scanner. Now what I'm going to do is reread the construction section, and then we'll go to the magnet. The major components of construction and operation. The major components of an MRI scan are the main magnet, which polarizes the sample, the shim coils for correcting the inhomogeneities in the magnetic field, the gradient system, which is used to localize the MR signal, and the RF system, which excites the sample and detects the resulting MR signal. The whole system is controlled by one or more computers, some pretty powerful computers. What I don't think they have added in there is the demodulator, some of the electronics on the pickup. And when it says to localize the MR signal, it is to encode locality information on the actual RF signal and then pull that out, which is what they could mean. So localize would mean that the signal is localized, so it's actually not. It's actually encoded. It's got locality encoding. So this is various things you pick up. Little things like using big T when they should use tau. And they actually do mention tau when they describe it. So tau, or T decay time, that we've got a little symbol for relaxation times as opposed to instrument time. Okay, we're going into the magnets. The magnet is the largest and most expensive component of the scanner, and the remainder of the scanner is built around it. The strength of the magnet is measured in Teslas, T, capital T, as Teslas small t, because that's a unit. Clinical magnets generally have a field strength between 0.1 and 3 teslas, with research systems up to a whopping 9.4 for human use and 21 teslas for animal systems. In the United States, field strengths up to 4 teslas have been approved for clinical use, so there must be something across. And the actual gradients going inside your brain induces fields inside your head, and you can actually feel twitching. You can actually, besides the enormous noise, you can actually feel twitching, or could feel twitching. So I was too relaxed to see it. Just as important as the strength of the main magnet is precision. The straightness of the magnetic field lines within the center, or as it is technically known, the isocenter of the magnet, needs to be near perfect. This is known as homogeneity. Fluctuations, inhomogeneities in field strengths within the scan should be less than 3 parts per million. So, 0.3% is 3 parts per thousand. And so, what that would mean is what you measure. So is that per meter or per scanning region? It's hard to know what they mean by that. 3 types of magnets have been used. Permanent magnets, my godfather. Conventional magnets made from ferromagnetic materials, e.g. steel alloys containing rare earth elements such as neodymium. Well, that's interesting because the little magnets that you have, that we all have, those little super magnets, are not metal alloys. They're sintered ceramics. So they're not technically called an alloy. So that's interesting. Or at least they're a nano. They're calling them steel. Is it calling it steel? Steel alloys. Steel is a definition of steel, I think, is iron with carbon in it, so I don't understand why they call it steel. A permanent magnet that is powerful enough to be used in an MRI is extremely large and bulky and can weigh over 1,100 tons. Well, it's 20 tons in a of magnet in a wind farm turbine. What is it? 2 tons? I can't remember. I think it's 2 tons, so this is amazing. Permanent magnets of MRIs are very inexpensive to maintain. Very inexpensive. Oh, yeah. This cannot be said of other types of MRI magnets, but there are significant drawbacks to using permanent magnets. They are only capable of achieving weak field strengths compared to other MRI, usually less than 0.4 teslas. They are also limited precision and stability. Permanent magnets also present special safety issues, so magnetic fields cannot be turned off. So this is one of the things that you know when you're building magnets, is that you put a magnet in and it will exponentially decay with time. Now the interesting thing is that in terms of the investment, you can recycle a permanent magnet a bit more easily, like the neodymium can be re-harvested, so the actual price. Now this is interesting, that if you buy a neodymium magnet now, and there's a long-term shortage, that's a good investment, because that's gold bullion in the bank, it's appreciating. But if there's more neodymium found, it's an expensive investment, because you can't recoup it. It's one of those accounting things. Objects are virtually impossible to remove once they become in direct contact. I know. Permanent magnets also require special care when they are being brought to the site of installation. You can't, well, you can't knock them. Resistive electromagnets. A solenoid wound with copper wire is an alternative to a permanent magnet. Advantages to the initial low cost, but the field strength and stability are limited. Electromagnets require considerable electrical energy during operation, which can make it expensive to operate. This design is essentially obsolete. Well, it is obsolete. Okay. But it still can provide very, very powerful, cheap, you know, field. Superconducting magnets. When a niobium tantalum or niobium tin alloy is killed with liquid helium, it becomes a superconductor. So it's niobium. Now, I think niobium is also something which doesn't fatigue. I know that they use niobium as the early gravity wave detectors. Losing resistance to the flow of electricity, an electromagnet constructed with superconductors can be extremely high field strength, very high stability. The construction of such magnets is extremely costly. With cryogenic helium is expensive and difficult to handle. However, despite their cost, helium-cooled superconducting magnets are the most common type found in scanners today. I think, I don't know what they're saying, this is only helium superconductors. And yes, it's expensive, but it's like any industrial theme. Yeah, so it's like, I used to be in labs where they had helium, and it was so much fun, the liquid helium. Most superconducting magnets have their coils superconductive wire immersed in liquid helium inside a vessel called a cryostat. Despite thermal insulation, sometimes including a second cryostat containing liquid nitrogen, ambient heat causes the helium to slowly boil off. Such magnets therefore require regular topping up of liquid helium. Oh, so they don't recycle the helium. Generally, a cryocooler, also known as a cold head, is used to recondense some of the helium vapor back to the helium bar. Several manufacturers now offer cryogenless scanners instead of being immersed in liquid helium, the magnet's wire is cooled directly by the cryocooler. Wow. I just wonder how the cryocooler works, whether it's a Peltier effect. I don't know how it does. Magnets are available in a variety of shapes. However, permanent magnets are most frequently C-shaped. The superconducting magnetic fields are frequently cylindrical. However, C-shaped superconducting magnets are box-shaped. Permanent magnets are also available. So, I'm just finding that hard to imagine. So, I have a North Pole at one... Oh, yeah, you can imagine a North Pole at one end. Essentially, you've got pole pieces coming down, so so it would actually mean that you've got a relatively thin section of the Z direction. So it is C shape in cross section. So it's still cylindrical, but the poles, rather than just pointing out, point down towards the patient. Magnetic field strength is an important factor in determining image quality. You betcha. High field strengths increase signal to noise ratio, preventing higher resolution and faster scanning. However, high field strengths require more costly magnets with higher maintenance costs and have increased safety concerns. A field strength of 1 to 1.5 is a good compromise between cost and performance in general medical use. However, for certain specialist uses, e.g. brain imaging, high field strengths are desirable, with some hospitals now using 3 Tesla scanners. And so there's the ones in universities are 7 Teslas, or the one in Queensland University. Now, here we go, the shims. Okay, I just really wonder how the shims are. I could imagine that what you really want is a sort of robotic adjustment solution, so you'd be there for hours. When MRI scanners is placed in a hospital or clinic, its magnetic field is far from being homogeneous enough for use in scanning. That's why doing fine tuning of the field using a sample and a magnetic field of a magnet must be measured and shimmed. So you put your little block in there, and you should just get, instead of a brain, you just put a block of jelly, and you should just get a nice featureless, you know, jelly should have no features in it. And you just shim out all the features. After the sample is placed in the scanner, the magnetic field is distorted by susceptibility boundaries within the samples, causing signal drop-up, ridges with low signals, and spatial distortions in the acquired image. For humans and animals, the effect is particularly pronounced. The air tissue boundaries are such as sinuses due to paramagnetic oxygen of air. So paramagnetic means that... Now, this is interesting that the oxygen is paramagnetic, and where it sits in the periodic table. So oxygen is magnetic, and iron is magnetic. Oxygen is sitting in the same place as... And neodymium is all sitting in the same place in the periodic table. And you can see, for me, my sinuses are picked, in some of the scans, are picked up as completely white, filled in. Making the frontal lobes of the brain difficult to image. To restore field homogeneity, a set of shim coils is included in the scanner. These are resistive coils, usually at room temperature, capable of producing field corrections disturbed by as several orders distributed in several orders of spherical harmonics. Oh, so you get your Fourier stuff, so you have a little bit of electrical coil, so they're actually not shims. It's sort of the old idea of shims, that they're actual coils in there. So that's an interesting thing to go. You can imagine a good animation of this would be so much helpful. But the whole, like, can I say, I really don't think, no, it's not, you don't have to be smart to, understand Fourier stuff, but you have to have hands-on experience, and I think just writing a paper, as this is, makes it, difficult to comprehend. Now, it's interesting here that they show the free induction decay, so it's no echo, you excite the particle, the thing, and then you just watch it come out. After placing a sample in the scanner, the B field is shimmed by adjusting the currents in the shim coil. So that's exactly what a computer would just calculate and do. Field homogeneity is measured by examining the FID signal in the absence of field gradients. The FID from poorly shimmed samples will show a complex decay envelope, often with many bumps. Shim currents are then adjusted to produce a large amplitude exponential decay FID, indicating a homogeneous B not field. The process is usually automated. Well, there you go. Far out. It'd have to be automated. But what I was going to say is, the FID is, your ring down. And of course, if the field is different in your area, so what you do is you wouldn't worry about the locality. You'd just say, look, because you don't want to, it's no point having high resolution of a uniform field, you just want to see it. And it's beautiful that they can use this Fourier stuff to pick it out. So FID is your T2 star, is your de-aligning, and you just put a bit of jelly in there. I prefer jelly because you don't have anything there. Well, in fact, it would be rather interesting because when you're making jelly, you could just make it very interesting. Jelly is very much like brains. Okay, gradient coils are usually used to spatially encode the positions of the protons by varying the magnetic field strength linearly across the imaging volume. Now, the entire thing is, I can sort of imagine, I can see the X, Y, Z. Z one's a bit interesting. So it's not literally, it's not adding a small XYZ component. It's just like the tensor value there. Gradient coils, okay. The Lamor frequency will then vary as a function of position X, Y, and Z axis. Why don't you actually bloody well say that? Well, it will vary a little bit in a complex Fourier space, such you can pick it out. Granite coils are usually resistive to electromagnetic power by sophisticated amplifiers, which will permit rapid and precise adjustment of their field strength and direction. And what would happen is sort of like robotics. It would have an induction, and it would calculate the output required. It would drive them such that there's no induction. A coil is basically inductor, but you can actually do it. So it's similar to robotics, where you can actually move a 10-kilogram weight from one point to the other and not shake it at all, because it's worked out all the shakes inside it. Gradient coils are usually resistive. Typical gradient systems are capable of producing a gradient of between 20 and 100 millitesla per meter, i.e., you know, 1.5 tesla magnet. When a maximal z-axis gradient is applied, the strength varies from 1.45 at one end to 1.55 at the other. That's in the z-axis. It is the magnetic gradients that determine the plane of imaging, because orthogonal gradients can be combined freely at any plane for selecting an image. Scan speed is dependent on performance of the gradient system. Stronger gradients allow for faster image or higher resolution. Similarly, gradient systems capable of faster switching can also permit faster scanning. However, gradient systems' performance is limited by safety concerns over nerve stimulation. That's exactly right. And I saw you can actually just whack up someone literally make it someone's head and give them a religious experience. It's pretty amazing. Some important characteristics of gradient amplifiers, the gradient coils, are slew rate and gradient strength. As I mentioned earlier, gradient coils will create an additional linearly varying magnetic field that adds or subtracts from the main gradient field. This additional magnetic field will have components in all three directions, X, Y, Z. However, only the components along the magnetic field, usually called the z-axis, denoted GX, is useful for imaging. Blood oath, that's what I was trying to say before. And so it's like a tensor. Along any given apex accent, the gradient will add to the magnetic field on one side of the zero position and subtract it from the other. Well, that's a gradient for you, mate. Since the additional field is a gradient, its units are Gauss per centimeter or millitesla per millimeter. High-performance gradient coils use MRI, a typical capable producing magnetic field of approximately 30 millitesla per meter or higher for a 1.5 tesla MRI. The slew rate of gradient system is a measure for how quickly the gradients can be ramped on or off. Higher performance gradients have a slew rate of up to 100 tesla per meter per second. The slew rate, this depends on the gradient of the coil. It takes more time to ramp up or down a large coil than a small coil. On the performance of the gradient amplifier, that takes a lot of voltage to overcome inductance of the coil. There you go, blood oath. So you can actually basically put in a square wave, you get this sloppy thing. So you put in a hyperscale wave with lots of edges in it, and you can get a square wave out, which is fundamentally the thing you've got to. A square wave itself has Fourier components in it. That really, well, I just think we've got a damn good thing. I can't see the real rush in MRI systems. I think we've just reached a certain time. I think it's clinically just a joy. Radio frequency, just trying to think of the number of years it took us to get x-rays going, you know, all through World War One and all that type of stuff, and you know, it's about 40 years before we got a safe x-ray going across. I can't see, as long as you're not giving the person a heart attack, I just don't see, there's physical stresses. I just ramp them up and give them the sedatives, in my view. Radio frequency system. The radio frequency RF transmission system consists of a RF synthesizer, power amplifier, and transmitting coil. Okay, thanks for saying that. The coil is usually built into the body of the scanner. The power of the transmitter is variable, but high-end whole-body scanners, wow, whole-body MRI scanner, I suppose that once you, you know, if you've got the field contained, it's okay. May use up to 35 kilowatts and be capable of sustaining an average power of 1 kilowatt, although the electromagnetic fields are in the RF range of 10 gigahertz, often the shortwave radio portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, at powers usually exceeding the highest powers used by amateur radio, where very little RF interference produced by the MRI. The reason for this is that the MRI are not radio transmitters. Blood oath. If they were transmitting... The RF frequency electromagnetic field is produced by a transmitting coil in the magnetic field, the magnetic near field, with very little associated change in electric field component, such as conventional radios have a radio... It's not an antenna. Not conventional. Thus, high-powered electromagnetic field produced by the MRI scanner does not produce much electromagnetic radiation at the RF frequency. Power is combined, well, it's obviously, it does produce RF power combined in there. So I do remember friends who were in the Vietnam War. Well, obviously, I wasn't there at the same time. And they used to stand up in front of the big RF antennas and heat themselves up in the morning. It's pretty amazing. Okay. The power is confined to the coil space and not radiated as radio waves. Thus, the transmitting coil is a good EM field transmitter at radio frequency, but poor EM radiation transmitter at radio. I think this person is deeply confused. You need the detachment of your A vector to get something. You've got to detach it. So it's just like the light stored inside an atom. You need an antenna to produce it, but you can produce a large field within an object, which isn't a good antenna. And that's the entire thing. You can hook up your FM or your radio transmitter to a poor antenna. It just means the energy is held in the antenna and not radiated out. I don't know why they're talking about this type of stuff. The receiver consists of a coil, preamplifier, and signal processing system. The RF electromagnetic radiation produced by, oh, it's finishing soon here, by nuclear relaxation inside the, is true EM radiation. Ah, this is appalling. I may be stupid. I may be out of it. I may not have been to lectures for long enough, and they may have changed it all. They may have revised Maxwell's equations. And these leave the subject as RF radiation. Well, of course, they're really small, so this is one of the basic things, is they've got a small antenna structure. But as such, low power as to not cause reciprocal RF interference that can be picked up by nearby radio tuners. In addition, MRI scanners are generally situated in a metal mesh lined room that acts as Faraday cages. While it's possible to scan using an integrated coil of the RF transmission and the MRI signal reception, if a small region is to be imaged, it is then a better image quality, i.e. signal, is obtained by using a close-fitting smaller coil. A variety of coils are available to fit closely around parts of the body, such as the head, knee, wrists, etc., and rectum, or stick one up your bum. A recent development in MRI technology has been the development of sophisticated multi-element phase arrays coils, such as acquiring multiple channels of data in parallel. This parallel imaging technique uses unique acquisition schemes that allow accelerated imaging by replacing some of the spatial coding originating from the magnetic gradients with spatial sensitivity of different coils. However, increased acceleration also reduces the signal-to-noise ratio that can create residual artifacts in imagery construction. Two frequently used parallel acquisition and reconstruction schemes are known as SENSE and GRAPPA. A detailed review of the parallel imaging techniques can be found here on such a thing. So eventually it will come across. So, it's amazing. We think they're amazing, but in years to come, they'll have different schemes. I think the major thing is they just boil off the helium in a cheap commercial way. So that's the final, or not the final talk on MRI scanners, and we'll get back to it. And you can just see the air is littered. It's almost too close to explain it. Nowadays, I could imagine an MRI, sorry, a Wikipedia article from the 30s explaining X-rays, and I'd have a lot of difficulty explaining it. So the major things that we found out here is that you encode the spatial information by converting the frequency. So the entire thing is that you can set up a gradient and just excite a purely one frequency. If you set up a gradient, you can then just excite at one frequency in. That's okay. Then you can actually then modulate those frequencies. It's battery, so that's a radio. So it's, you've charged, there's a charging frequency, which is determines your imaging plane. That's okay. And then you can then tweak the frequencies coming back. Store, it's like it retransmits it. And so you can change the retransmission by applying a gradient to it. Now, it's not just, you don't just put, what's complicated is you just don't put things at a gradient. It's actually, you chirp the frequency. So things in the center where the gradient isn't changing have one frequency, and higher up it chirps, and that's where it's a bit harder to come across. I can imagine if you just click a gradient, you have a whole different frequency range, but how it chirps the frequency is interesting. It's a bit more complicated than they've actually said there, and there's it shows a lack of understanding of in this article, and look, no one's listening to me, but there's a lack of understanding about antenna and where the electromagnetic field is. So if your radio signal just broadcasts to the universe where your A vector or your B and E vectors are together, yes, essentially there's no electric field. The electrons, there's no electric, it's a purely magnetic field doodad, and like it's a magnet transmitter, but however your radio signals is electric fields, because you put a wire up to your radio, it's electric field going, you don't have magnetic field, it's electric field. Now of course the electric field and magnetic field couple in your antenna to push it out, but this is not the case here. I find that they're rather confused, or I am rather confused by the way they explain things. Thanks a lot for listening as I get on to the next thing in this rehab world as I continue working on it. Thanks a lot. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.